Welcome to the new episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And finally, welcome to the last episode in our season on Haunted Hollywood, which is, as always, hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. We hope you've enjoyed this season, although maybe enjoy is not the right word for tales of murder, mayhem, suicide, revenge, and the kind of broken hearts and dreams that only the City of Angels can offer. We know it's been a long season, but we had a lot of stories to tell, and we still have just one more. We wanted to make sure that the season went out with a bang, and we couldn't figure out a better person to do that with. But if you somehow have ended up here without listening to everything that came before, we'll encourage you to go back to episode 70 and start from there. Just be aware that the episodes of the season are definitely not suitable for all listeners. So if you continue on from here, you can't say we didn't warn you, because we have. 27 times now. So let's get the last party started. I would be willing to say there is not a single Hollywood legend that has inspired as much enthusiasm and outright worship over the years as Marilyn Monroe has. She's one of Hollywood's greatest icons, and the facts, rumors, legends, and lies about her life and death have become an essential part of Tinseltown's lore. On the surface, Marilyn seemed to live the glamorous life of a movie star and celebrity, but she was also very private, very smart, and an often very troubled woman. Part of this enduring fame comes from the fact that she was gone too soon, a victim of apparent suicide at the age of only 36, and she remains with us, frozen in time, always young, always beautiful. Taken from us too soon, she leaves behind many mysteries, mostly about her death, which refused to go away. Many believe she was murdered, naming one culprit after another, including both the mob and an American president and his brother in her demise. Of course, a secret murder must be linked to a conspiracy to cover up the crime, leading to questions, theories, and lingering doubts about what really happened. And thanks to this, the death of Marilyn Monroe just might be one of Hollywood's greatest unsolved mysteries, and may provide the reason why her ghost continues to linger in Hollywood today. She was born Norma Jean Mortensen on June 1st, 1926. Her mother, Gladys, had previously been married to a businessman named John Baker. After that ended, Gladys married a gas company meter man named Martin Mortensen, but they separated in 1925, months before she became pregnant with Norma Jean, making her baby's father one of a number of different candidates. Gladys spent most of her daughter's early years in mental institutions, which meant Norma Jean lived in foster homes and later in an orphanage. Her mother had a messy life, which Norma Jean didn't want for herself. So in June 1942, rather than be sent off to another foster home, the 16-year-old married James Doherty, a 22-year-old aircraft factory worker. James was soon drafted and sent overseas during World War II, and Norma Jean worked in a factory inspecting parachutes. Then in 1944, she was photographed by the Army as a promotion to show women on the assembly line contributing to the war effort. One of the photographers asked to take more pictures of her, and the rest is, yes, it's history. By the following spring, she had appeared on the covers of 33 national magazines. But Norma Jean didn't want to be just a model. She wanted to be famous, and the best way to do that was in the movies. In July 1946, the would-be actress screen-tested for 20th Century Fox and was soon signed to a $75 per week contract. The studio selected a new name for her, Marilyn Monroe, and gave her a minor part in the film Scudda Who, Scudda Hey. And no, I've never seen it. That September, she got her first divorce. Marilyn only appeared in a few small parts for Fox, and after 6 months, she was dropped, a decision they'd later regret. She ended up at Columbia Pictures, where she signed a new contract for $125 a week. There, she earned a part in the musical Ladies of the Chorus. Rumor has it that she ruined her chances on the lot because she refused to do special favors for studio mogul Harry Cohen. At the time, Marilyn was involved with vocal coach and music arranger Fred Karger. When he dropped her for another girlfriend, though, Marilyn was devastated. In 1949, she met agent Johnny Hyde of the William Morris Agency. He was married, short, unattractive, and 31 years older than Marilyn. Nevertheless, she became involved with the high powered agent, who is the one responsible for not only convincing Marilyn to pose nude for a now famous calendar shot, but also for really getting her career off the ground. Her first major role came in 1950 in The Asphalt Jungle, which earned her great reviews. This was followed by All About Eve and many others. Johnny Hyde died in 1950, but by then Marilyn was doing it all on her own. She was back at Fox and they had groomed her to become the studio's next blonde bombshell. It was all very exciting, but it wasn't perfect, at least as far as Marilyn was concerned. Her rapid rise to fame had stoked her many insecurities, which made her temperamental on and off the set. She was now a marquee attraction and used her newfound power to reject many of the projects the studio tried to push her into, especially those that made her look like a dumb blonde, a part she hated. She asked for more substantial roles, but her requests were ignored, which increased her frustration and added to her lack of self-confidence. In 1952, Marilyn met and fell in love with Joe DiMaggio, the most famous baseball player in the entire country at the time. That same year, she began filming Niagara with Joseph Cotten, a film that would establish her stardom, although Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Jane Russell made her a legend. On January 14, 1954, Marilyn and Joe were married. The wedding made headlines all over the world, but the dream romance was never going to last. Joe was a jealous type who thought that Marilyn was going to drop out of the movie business and become a housewife, something she was never destined to be. Well, in the fall of 1954, they separated and were later divorced, but remained friends. And as we'll see later, Joe never stopped loving her. Her personal crisis over, Marilyn's stardom continued to grow with the release of The Seven-Year Itch. It was perhaps Marilyn's most iconic film, and even those who've never seen it can immediately recognize the scene that includes a white dress and a subway grate. In early 1955, against the studio's wishes, Marilyn went to New York and joined the Actors Studio, intent on becoming known as a serious actress. While there, she renewed her acquaintance with playwright Arthur Miller, and the two of them began an affair that would later lead to marriage. To Marilyn, Arthur represented the serious theater. She was much more attracted to his keen intellect than his looks. Marilyn returned to Hollywood in February 1956 after a year-long absence to film Bus Stop. She earned solid reviews for the picture, which prompted her demand for greater control over her films, wishes the studio ignored because she was difficult on the set. Well, as her conflicts with the studio bosses intensified, she drank more and was soon taking prescription pills. Marilyn sought relief from her problems by getting married again. She returned to New York in June, and she and Arthur Miller were married on June 29th. She hoped that this kind, older, and intellectual man would help her to deal with her growing problems. But a few months later, Marilyn suffered a miscarriage. It was followed by two more in 1957 and 1958. And during this emotionally draining period, she flew to England to star opposite Sir Laurence Olivier in The Prince and the Showgirl. It was an unhappy shoot, and the film failed with both audiences and critics. After London, though, she bounced back. She returned to Hollywood to make Some Like It Hot with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, and it would become a favorite of all of Marilyn's films for millions of her fans. Marilyn seemed to be on top of the world, but once again, behind the scenes, she was falling apart. Her unhappiness and sorrow over her miscarriages caused an increased dependency on prescription drugs, especially sleeping pills. The drugs badly affected her work. She was often late in arriving on the set and was unable to remember her lines. In 1960, she began seeing Dr. Ralph Greenson, the so-called psychoanalyst to the stars. As was common during this time, he relied heavily on prescribing barbiturates and tranquilizers, usually both, to accompany his therapy. One got you up in the morning, the other put you to sleep at night. In July 1960, Marilyn started filming The Misfits. The movie was based on a short story by Arthur Miller, but while on location, he and Marilyn lived in separate quarters and barely spoke. The entire set was tense. Marilyn managed to turn in an exceptional performance, even though she was taking so many pills that refills had to be flown in from her doctor. The shoot was also marked by tragedy. On the day after filming was completed, Marilyn's co-star Clark Gable suffered a serious heart attack and died. Marilyn felt a tremendous amount of guilt over his death, further aggravating her depression. By late 1960, her marriage with Arthur Miller had completely unraveled. Their divorce became final in Juarez, Mexico in January 1961. And by this time, Marilyn was out of control. At one point, she was hospitalized and detoxed off all the drugs, but even that didn't help. She became suicidal. And in February 1961, she was sent to the psychiatric ward at the Payne Whitney Clinic, where she was confined for 7 horrifying days. She was locked into a padded cell, and Marilyn, even more distraught, called Joe DiMaggio and asked him to rescue her. Joe came running. He immediately got her out of the hospital and took her home. Over the spring and summer of 1961, Marilyn managed to level out, but she was never really herself again. The alcohol, the drugs, the hospitals, and the control that Ralph Greenson had over her had taken their toll. Then in October 1961, Marilyn had her first meeting with President John F. Kennedy at a dinner party that was hosted by his sister, Pat, and his brother-in-law, actor Peter Lawford, at the couple's home in Santa Monica. A few months later, Marilyn and Kennedy met again at a New York dinner gathering. Their third meeting occurred in late March 1962 at the Palm Springs house of Bing Crosby, where she and Kennedy were both house guests. Allegedly, this is when the president and the movie star began their short-lived affair. That same year, Marilyn purchased the first and only house she ever owned, a Spanish-style home in the Brentwood section of L.A. At Dr. Greenson's urging, she hired Eunice Murray as her housekeeper. Murray called herself a nurse, but had no training nor any official credentials. It's thought that Murray was simply a spy for Greenson, who continued to have more and more control over Marilyn's life. He saw her daily whenever she was in Hollywood. In April, Marilyn finally went back to work and started filming a romantic comedy called Something's Got to Give with Dean Martin. She put on a brave face, but underneath it all, she was an emotional wreck. On days when she actually managed to make it to the set, she struggled to remember her lines. There was a lot of tension at the studio at that time. Most of it was caused by the cost overruns on the set of the new Cleopatra film, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. It was way over budget and months behind schedule. Worried executives suggested canceling Marilyn's film, which had a lower budget and a smaller cast, and using the money they saved to finish Cleopatra. Well, in protest, Marilyn flew to New York to sing happy birthday to President Kennedy at Madison Square Garden. The now infamous clip was widely publicized, and Marilyn's well-documented absence from the movie set made studio bosses even angrier. Perhaps realizing she'd gone too far, Marilyn was much easier to work with when she returned to Hollywood, but by then it was too late. On June 1st, Marilyn turned 36 and celebrated with a small party on the set, but 6 days later, Fox fired her for unprofessional antics. The studio also filed a $750,000 lawsuit against their former star and attempted to recast her part in the film, but Dean Martin refused to work with anyone else but Marilyn. Well, cooler heads prevailed and the studio suggested a compromise. After Dean completed some other film commitments, the movie would restart again with Marilyn as the leading lady. No one knew it at the time, but that was never going to happen. In her downtime, Marilyn contemplated some other offers and took a couple of short trips to New York and Mexico City. On August 1st, she signed a contract for $250,000 to finish filming Something's Got to Give. It looked as though things were finally settling down in Marilyn's life, but that wasn't the case. On Saturday, August 4th, 1962, Marilyn was at home all day. Her only guest was her publicist, Pat Newcomb. Later reports would claim that Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, visited the house that day, but there's no proof of that. Around 5 p.m., Dr. Greenson came over for their usual session. Then around 8 p.m., Marilyn went to her bedroom and took the telephone from the hall into her room with her. She made several phone calls that night, including one to Joe DiMaggio's son, Joe Jr., who'd recently broke up with his girlfriend. Marilyn had called to console him. She also called Peter Lawford to cancel a dinner invitation. Marilyn allegedly said to Lawford, quote, "Peter, I don't think I'm going to make it tonight because I don't feel well. Will you say goodbye to Pat and to Jack and to yourself because you're a nice guy?" Lawford supposedly became concerned about the goodbye portion of her call and wanted to rush over to check on her, but was advised not to. As the president's brother-in-law, it could generate adverse publicity for everyone if there actually was something amiss. Lovely people, right? But Peter genuinely cared for Marilyn, and while he didn't go over to her house, he did continue to try and check on her that night. After being unable to reach Marilyn, he called her agent, and he called the house. Eunice Murray answered the call at 9:30 p.m. and said that the telephone extension was still in Marilyn's room, so she must be fine. She always placed the telephone outside her room at night. She had trouble sleeping and didn't want it to be disturbed if it rang. It's unknown how many other calls came into or were made from Marilyn's house that night. The telephone records for the night of August 4th mysteriously disappeared after being obtained by the authorities from the phone company. According to the official count of Marilyn's death, Eunice Murray noticed a light shining under her bedroom door at about midnight. She later changed that time to 3:25 a.m. The police were not called until an hour after that. But it gets even weirder. Eunice Murray first claimed that she had called Dr. Greenson at midnight because she was worried about Marilyn. She later changed that time, but Peter Lawford, who was still calling, claimed that he'd been told Marilyn had died around midnight. Her attorney, Milt Rudin, also said he'd been told she died around midnight by Dr. Greenson himself. What we do know is that at some point, Greenson told Murray to go outside and look into Marilyn's window because she was not answering when Murray knocked on the door. She said that her view of Marilyn on the bed looked, quote, peculiar, so she telephoned Dr. Greenson and asked him to come over. When he arrived, he broke one of the glass panes of the bedroom's French doors and entered her bedroom. Marilyn seemed to be unconscious. Greenson then called Marilyn's personal doctor, Dr. Hyman Engelberg, who pronounced Marilyn dead at the scene. Either a short time or an hour later, depending on who's telling the story, the police were summoned to the house. When LAPD Sergeant Jack Clemens arrived, he found several people at the house, including the two doctors and Eunice Murray. Clemens later said, quote, it looked like a convention, and added something, quote, wasn't kosher. Clemens noted that he found Marilyn lying naked, face down, and at an angle on the bed in the sparsely furnished master bedroom. He said that her arm seemed to be reaching out for the nearby telephone. An empty bottle of sleeping pills was found next to the bed. There were 10 to 14 other bottles on the nightstand, all of them containing prescription medicines of various kinds, all of which had been prescribed by Dr. Greenson. Marilyn's body was taken to the Westwood Village mortuary, and the house was sealed and placed under guard. Later, in his own writings about that night, Sergeant Clemens recalled that Eunice Murray was running the washing machine when he arrived. It was in the middle of the night, and she had just found her employee dead, which made washing clothes seem like a very odd thing to do. When he asked her about it, and, well, about anything that happened that night, he noted that she acted strangely and was evasive with her answers. Detective Sergeant Robert E. Byron, who arrived on the scene a few minutes after Clemens, also wrote in his report that Murray acted oddly. He wrote, quote, it is this officer's opinion that Mrs. Murray was vague and possibly evasive in answering questions pertaining to the activities of Miss Monroe during this time. Conspiracy theorists have used Murray's behavior that tragic night as proof there was something inappropriate and fishy going on, and that perhaps the housekeeper knew more about it than she was letting on. But I'll let you decide that for yourself, because her story isn't over yet. Marilyn's body was later taken to the county morgue, where Los Angeles County Deputy Medical Examiner Thomas T. Noguchi conducted the high-profile autopsy. Noguchi would later claim that because of his youth and relative inexperience, he made several mistakes in the case. He also went on to claim that he was pressured by his supervisors to sign an autopsy report that attributed Marilyn's death to acute barbiturate poisoning, ingestion of overdose. It was ruled a suicide. Oddly, though, no traces of barbiturates were found in her stomach, her intestines, or in her liver. After the body was released by the coroner, Joe DiMaggio came to Marilyn's rescue once more. He flew from San Francisco to supervise the funeral arrangements. Marilyn was buried at Westwood Memorial Park, where for the next several decades, red roses were delivered to her crypt each week, courtesy of DiMaggio. Joe died at the age of 85 in 1999, and until the day he died, he regretted losing Marilyn and told his friends that he had hoped to remarry her. Reportedly, not long before his death, Joe told his attorney and friend, Morris Engelberg, quote, I'll finally get to see Marilyn again. Marilyn was gone, but she was not forgotten, and she certainly was not allowed to rest in peace. Many refused to believe she committed suicide, generating controversy and conspiracies that continue to this day. The most popular theories claim that she'd been silenced to protect the reputation of the Kennedy family, or as revenge against the Kennedys, or something worse. It's true, there are a lot of inconsistencies in the various stories of that night, but whether a plot existed to kill Marilyn Monroe remains a mystery. And it doesn't help that so many of the accounts that have emerged in recent years are so crazy. For instance, a man named Walter Schaefer, owner of the private Schaefer Ambulance Company, claimed that he received a call at about 2 a.m. on the night of Marilyn's death. She was still alive when he got to her home and he delivered her to Santa Monica Hospital, where she died in the emergency room. He didn't have an explanation for how she was found back at her house, naked on the bed, reaching for the telephone. Someone moved her body, he shrugged. And then there's a story about Peter Lawford from the always reliable source of an ex-wife. Deborah Gould, the ex, claimed that Peter and a private detective went to Marilyn's house to, quote, clean things up after she was found dead and that Peter destroyed a note she'd written. Deborah also stated that Peter told her, quote, Marilyn took her last big enema. At the time of her death, the actress had allegedly been having trouble with bowel movements because of all the prescription drugs she was taking. But Deborah claimed that wasn't what he meant. She claimed Marilyn had been given an enema that contained an overdose of drugs. Because if Peter Lawford was involved somehow, that linked Marilyn's death to the Kennedys, the source of all the best, if that's the right word, conspiracy theories. Her death happened for one simple reason, the theorists claim, because of her affair with John Kennedy. If there was actually an affair, and how serious it was if it occurred, is still the subject of debate. We do know that they knew each other, and Kennedy did have a track record of having women on the side, but the evidence is still pretty circumstantial. White House telephone logs do show that they spoke on the phone numerous times, yet proving the two had an actual affair has been problematic. Somewhere along the line, the president's brother, Robert Kennedy, was also added to the mix. Bobby Kennedy flew to LA on August 1st, just days before Marilyn's death, to give a speech for the California Bar Association. The stories say that he saw Marilyn later that evening at Peter Lawford's house during a hastily scheduled dinner party. Some have speculated that Marilyn organized the dinner herself, while others claim that Bobby arranged the evening primarily to tell Marilyn to stay away from his brother. But it didn't go as planned, and Bobby ended up sleeping with Marilyn, which complicated the situation even further. Their meeting ended badly, though, with Bobby again warning her to stay away from the Kennedys. That forced Marilyn, who was already emotionally distraught, to threaten to expose the contents of a diary she kept, contents that allegedly contained some pretty unsavory information regarding her affair with the president and about the Kennedys' collusion with organized crime. Which brings us to the other most popular theory. This one claims Marilyn was killed by the mob. The Kennedys did have ties with organized crime that dated all the way back to Prohibition, when Joseph Kennedy was building his fortune with bootlegging. It's also claimed that during the 1960 election, the mob put their muscle behind John Kennedy, especially in Chicago, to ensure that he won the presidency. In return, they were given assurances that mob activities would be untouched during the Kennedy administration. But by 1962, it had become painfully obvious that the Kennedys had no intention of keeping up their end of the bargain. In 1960, for example, a mere 19 organized crime figures had been indicted. But within the first 2 years of the Kennedy administration, 121 mafia bosses were indicted by the Attorney General, who just happened to be Robert Kennedy. That left the mob with only one solution: to get the Kennedys out of the way. They tried to do this first by revealing the president's messy affair with Marilyn, then arranging her death so that the Kennedys appeared to be involved, and finally, and we are not getting into all of that, killing John Kennedy in Dallas with Lee Harvey Oswald as a patsy. A patsy who was then killed in a parking garage by Jack Ruby, a Chicago strip bar owner with ties to the mob. But listen, let's not get down that rabbit hole. The mob's plan, if there was a plan, didn't really work out, though. The possible connection between Marilyn and the Kennedys would not really become a part of popular culture until long after almost everyone involved was dead. And the only reason we started talking about it at all was because of Norman Mailer's biography of Marilyn, which was published in 1973. In most versions of the conspiracy, Bobby Kennedy was Marilyn's actual killer, or at least he ordered it to be done. It wasn't until Mailer's book that people began to theorize that Marilyn had an affair with Bobby too, and that her involvement with the Kennedys is what led to her death. Mailer was savaged by the critics for his claims, which are of course pretty mainstream today, but weren't back then. When Mailer said that he thought it was more likely that Marilyn died from an accidental overdose, he was asked why he felt the need to bring the Kennedys into the whole mess. His reply, quote, I needed money very badly. If there really was some sort of conspiracy involved with Marilyn's death, a more obvious one would involve her analyst, Dr. Greenson. He was the one who provided Marilyn with her drugs, and on that day, he had brought her a new prescription for Nembutal, a sedative used to treat insomnia. When the crime scene was examined by police detectives, the bottle of pills was empty. All 50 of them were gone. Those who believe that she committed suicide have suggested she simply swallowed all 50 of them. And yet, why were there no traces of the drugs in her stomach or intestinal tract? If she took all those pills, she would have had to administer them, all 50 of them, rectally. Yikes. She could have done this on her own, but if she was trying to kill herself, it seems more plausible that she would have just swallowed them. So if they went up her rectum, someone else likely did the dirty deed. But why? What did he have to gain from Marilyn's death? Well, I don't think he probably had anything to gain. I believe that Marilyn died of an overdose, but I don't think it was suicide. I do think it was an accident, though, likely involving Eunice Murray and, by extension, Dr. Greenson, since he'd gotten Marilyn to hire the untrained nurse in the first place, and also because he was the one giving her all the pills. I think all the odd time lapses, strange stories, and bizarre things that Murray and Greenson did that night were all to cover up Marilyn's accidental death and their part in it. But who knows? I'm not an expert, and there have been hundreds of books and articles written about Marilyn's death, and so far, no one has been able to solve any of the mysteries that are linked to it. What it boils down to is that Marilyn's death was strange and possibly suspicious. On the other hand, she had been plagued with mental and emotional issues all her life, just like her mother had. She didn't deal with her fame very well, and she'd had bad luck with relationships. So it's also possible she decided to kill herself, or, as I suggested, it was just an accident. Who knows? Maybe someone did kill her for any of the reasons alleged by the numerous conspiracy theories, or maybe it was for some other reason altogether. No one knows, let's face it. No one's ever going to know. And maybe that's the reason, as listeners to this podcast know, Marilyn's ghost is still said to linger at so many places in Hollywood. Like Valentino, she is a very well-traveled spirit. Perhaps the most likely spot to find her ghost is her former home in Brentwood. Rumor has it that her spirit was encountered many times in the room where she died, including by another troubled young woman who lived in the house, Anna Nicole Smith. Before her own early death, she claimed to frequently see and feel Marilyn's spirit in the house. One of the most famous locations where Marilyn's ghost has been encountered has been at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. A hotel employee named Suzanne Leonard was the first to encounter Marilyn's spectral image in a mirror that was hanging in a hotel office, but she hasn't been the last. It was later learned that that mirror once hung in Marilyn's favorite suite, which she often used when she wanted to escape from the pressures of her career. Apparently, Marilyn has been encountered in other ways at that hotel too. Singer Nick Lachey told a friend in 2006 that he'd entered an elevator in the hotel and was stunned to see a gorgeous blonde dressed in a sexy 1950s style evening dress. When he pressed the button for his floor and then turned around for a better look, the woman had vanished. Lachey was convinced that the phantom was Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn has also been reported at a getaway spot far from LA in Lake Tahoe. Lakeview Cabin No. 3 was Marilyn's favorite place to stay at the Cal Neva Resort, a resort also frequented by Frank Sinatra, whose ghost has also been spotted there at a bungalow he owned in the early 1960s. Back home, though, Marilyn's ghost has also been seen in her crypt in Westwood Village Memorial Park. This haunting is reportedly connected to Joe DiMaggio's weekly delivery of roses to her grave, which ended with the slugger's death in 99. Other admirers still leave flowers and other items at her grave today, but it's Joe's roses that Marilyn Spector allegedly waits for. A number of people claim that they have spotted her as a filmy cloud hovering nearby as she waits for her roses to be delivered to her tomb. Truth, fiction, or wishing so hard for something to happen you imagine it does? Who can say? Whatever the answer, Marilyn seems to have left an impression on Hollywood in more ways than one. Thanks for listening to this season, guys. I know the episode isn't over yet. Cody and I still have a little talking to do before it all ends, but I just wanted to say again for myself, thank you for your patience with this season. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you've had a lot of fun with it, and I hope you'll stick around to see what we've got coming up next. Thanks. There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book. And they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
That's true. That's so, how they do it.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Okay. Good?
Yeah.
All right.
On that note.
On that note, thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now, we're ending
this
season five of the podcast,
it's
Haunted Hollywood. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
It's kind of the end, as it turned out. Well, no, remember, he knows this. He's pretending he doesn't. But as it turned out, I had a few stories that I could not fit.
Okay. Yeah.
No. I'm not adding anything. Oh, so we're just going to add those last few stories onto for Patreon extra shows. So they'll have some that'll carry them a little later into the year.
Thank God.
On Patreon. So, but yeah, and you don't have to do anything with them. I'll take care of them myself.
I'm going to have to edit them,
but you know, I'm going to send them to you. You don't have to talk on them. So, and just as a bonus, as one of these Patreon bonus episodes, there will be an Orson Welles ghost story.
Oh my God.
I finally tracked one down.
Jeez.
And I thought, you know what? I cannot, even if it's not a long one, I cannot pass this
You
up.
Can't not do it.
No, I can't. Not at this point.
You gotta give the people
point.
What they want.
No, I got not at this point.
What they annoyingly want.
So I can't
want.
Believe this has been all this time we've drugged this out.
Really,
I love an old Orson Welles.
I know you do.
Oh, and well, you know what makes it even better?
What?
We're recording this. I know. We're recording this on October 30th.
Yes.
Do you know what October 30th is the anniversary of? The War of the Worlds radio broadcast by Orson Welles.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Nice. You know, so you should do a bonus episode just on that. Or did you already do that?
Well, I was actually going to do that as part of the bonus episode.
That's a cool story.
Yeah, a little bit about War of the Worlds and some of his other stuff, and then ended up with the ghost story.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. So,
all right.
It will be a Patreon episode.
I will, unfortunately.
So, if you guys
want to
hear
listen.
It, you're going to have to sign up for Patreon. So, which a lot of people have this month.
There has been a lot.
Yeah. It's frightening.
It's a spooky season, man.
Yeah, it is. They're trusting us.
They are. Well, like you said, it is, I mean, we are at the end.
Of
October.
I mean, technically, they're going to hear this on the 2nd. So sure. It's as close to Halloween as we could get it planned out. But yeah,
the season was so damn long.
Oh, God. Well, you know, I guess we could have flip-flopped our movie episode from last week, but I didn't want to. That was fun, man.
Yeah.
So those are always fun.
Yeah, we got a lot of positive
feedback about that. And
we'll
have another one before the end of the year.
I saw Antlers.
I know you did. I know.
We haven't talked about it yet.
We will talk about it because we haven't. I'm afraid I'm not gonna. I'm gonna try. Everything's just been so busy. I'm gonna try to see it before.
Yeah.
I want to get it onto my list one way or the other because I got a lot of stuff on my list.
I know you're gonna want to talk about it.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I'm sure. So
We can save that.
Awesome.
I know you have multiple things going on even tonight.
I know.
But a lot of people think that everything kind of ends once Halloween's over.
No.
That's not the case.
No.
What's up for the rest of the year next year?
I mean, well. As far as coming up for the rest of this year, a lot of stuff that's already full.
Yeah.
So every weekend between now and Christmas, I'm still busy every weekend.
That's awesome.
I have Thanksgiving weekend off. That's it.
Okay.
I know. So, but yeah, we did add a River Road tour for the 19th of November, which is, I added day before yesterday, and it's over half full already.
Nice.
But that's our friend Sam's birthday, so she's going to be back in town. So I said, "Well, we might as well do a River Road tour. Did one for my birthday, so." But yeah, it'll be fun. And so then we've got our Spirits of Christmas thing on the 11th of December, which that actually isn't sold out, but it's getting close. But then we've already posted stuff for the New Year. I mean, Dead of Winter's already up. We've got all kinds of dinners, River Road tours. All through the winter, and people think, why would I want to take a ghost tour in the winter? Because that's the best time.
That is true.
It's better than now. Yeah, it's chilly, but winter is ghost season. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really not, I mean, despite what we all think, it's really not October. I know we've talked about this before, but to the ancient people and even to Victorian era, I mean, 150 years ago, Halloween was the kind of the end of the year kind of thing. You know, the next day was always like the New Year's, and it was just the beginning of like the dark season. You know, you didn't celebrate all the way up until Halloween. You started with Halloween.
Right.
And that's when things got spooky. So we try to keep that alive by doing ghostly stuff in the winter.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I love it because this is the time I get to pile on my seasonal depression on top of the regular depression.
I know. But and that's one of the other reasons we always try to do stuff because there's nothing to do.
That's true.
And people complain because, and I get it. I mean, I complain too. There's nothing to
do.
Once you get past the holidays, which suck anyway, but once you get past the holidays, there's nothing to do. So we jam up January, February, and March with stuff, man.
Yeah.
I mean, Dead of Winter, and so that's a blast. So we've always got something going on. So anytime you're wondering if we've got something, go check out the website, because I guarantee you we do.
Do you have any new stuff or any, like, new dinners or anything that's
different?
Yeah,
I've added a few things. I'm bringing back some of the ones that, we're doing the evening dinner with the Donner Party.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
At the end of January, because that's when you want to talk about the Donner Party in the wintertime. So we did bring that back. And, you know, we've got some more of the St. Louis Exorcism, the uncensored ones coming up.
Oh, yeah.
And I added one in February, which is Evening with the American Witch, which is just, you know, it's going to be Salem witch trials, witchcraft stories, folk magic, all that kind of stuff. So that'd be kind of fun because it's a different... You know, witchcraft in America, the legendary, the history of it is a little different than Europe and that kind of thing. It's a lot more rootsy and a lot more, you know, related to areas and things. It'll be fun. I've been putting that together and I'm looking forward to that one. So, yeah, so I have been adding some new things. Mm-hmm. And I've got a new book coming out, which I'm not going to talk about yet.
Of course you do,
It'll be a holiday release for this year, and it is a holiday themed, so to speak, about something from the holiday. By the time you guys hear this, within a week or so, I'll have announced everything.
All right. Yeah, I have no idea.
But it's finished, and it's just in the finishing product checks
I just
now.
Don't understand how you crank out so many books.
I had some, well, I got all of our stuff done early, so I had some extra time. So
I like I'm accomplished. I like I wrote 5 emails today. No, but it, but still, you're just
I wrote a book this morning. Yeah. No, not this morning.
Gosh. So. All right. Well, not to stroke your ego anymore, but let's get into some listener reviews
Oh, sure.
of people that like the podcast and like what we're doing. This one,
that's good.
Yeah, I know, right? It's a nice change. Yeah. This one is titled "Even Better in Person." It's from Cocola Chip.
I don't know why you try to.
I know it's I and I also I just can't.
Gibberish.
I just can't. No, and this one probably makes sense.
Not
I just
the
can't
emails.
Read.
I mean the names. Names.
No, I know. I just can't read too. This says living in the St. Louis area. I've read and own many of Troy's books. I found the podcast 2 years ago. It gets better with every season. I appreciate the depth of research done for his books and this podcast. I was fortunate enough to attend the River Road tour this weekend and greatly enjoyed the evening. Yeah, Troy couldn't have been nicer. I've been a fan of his work for years.
That was nice.
They say you should never meet your heroes. Not sure about that. I was very pleased to meet Troy. Thanks for all that you do, Dan. It's just somebody going out of their way to call you
nice. I can't
wanted
be,
to highlight it.
I can be nice.
You're a nice guy.
I'm okay. my thing with a lot of times with those the in person things is that I am a moody individual. But I do enjoy doing those.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tend to reflect back what you get. If somebody comes up to me, you know, a Karen complaining about something, they're probably not going to be my favorite people on the tour since we haven't even left yet. But, you know, I do remember Dan, actually. So, and we had a really good time on that tour.
Well, that's awesome.
He came the week when the twins were here. We had a really good time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
that,
awesome.
With that weekend, we had a couple of tours that weekend. So. Yeah, it was
great.
Fun.
Well, yeah, I told you I left a wedding last night at the best man speech. Yeah, I was like, I'm done with people. So I totally get it. This last review is titled Haunted Hollywood. It's from Paranormal 66.
See that one?
That
got
one. Nailed it. Nailed it. Says, I love this season with like 1,000 exclamation points. I loved hearing all the ghost stories from Hollywood. I'm going to hate it when it ends. I've been a paranormal investigator for
Cody is too.
I've been a paranormal investigator for over 35 years. I've listened to many podcast shows throughout the years. I usually get bored with most of them, except for yours. I'm hooked, you guys. Keep the good episodes coming. That's from Paul. I wonder like what it is about when people say like, you know, I get bored with podcasts or whatever, especially things about paranormal. What is it about ours? It can't be the host and our dynamic.
It's not.
What is it that people keep coming back for? What do we have that's different?
I think the main thing is the way that we break it in half.
Yeah, that's you get the best of both worlds if you choose, kind of.
You can do whichever one you want or do both, and that was always what we said we wanted to do. We didn't want to. I mean, if we were doing a movie podcast, then it would be us just sitting and talking,
shooting shit. Yeah.
But because we do something with a history behind it, doing it the way that we do it, and I like a lot of podcasts like that too. I like both, but I wanted what we did to be both.
Do you listen to other podcasts that do what we do, where it's like a scripted monologue then a breakdown? Because I don't.
No, I don't either. That you mention it, most of the stuff on my list, the stuff I regularly listen to in my show library is mostly it's either people talking about horror movies or you know. It's someone telling a story, a crime story or whatever. Yeah. Or it's, like a dramatized, I listen to some of those too.
But I really love those audio dramas.
I'm looking at stuff here and I really don't think that I listen to anything.
It's either
like, there's got to be more out there.
It's
I'm
that
sure,
scary but. Thing of we either have a very novel idea or it's really
terrible.
Stupid and that's why people don't
that's
do
why
it.
No one has it, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, are you ready to dive into the last episode of the regular season?
I am ready. Yes.
Okay. I told everybody, I said, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but we're talking about the suspicious death of a blonde bombshell. And I'm not talking about myself.
Right.
Everyone laughed because it was classic comedy.
I'll be here all week.
Yeah, I'll be here all week. You said, on the surface, Marilyn seemed to live like a glamorous life. She's like the epitome of, I guess, you don't really know what happens behind closed doors kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think she really sums up a lot of what we talked about this Hollywood season, you know, and people, I think it takes a special kind of person to handle fame.
Yeah, especially that kind of fame, I think.
Yeah.
And it to be, you know, to want something different than what she has. And only because I think she enjoyed what she did, but she wanted to be a serious actor. And no one would take her seriously because Blonde Bombshell. And I think she always wanted to be taken seriously, which is what attracted her to guys like Arthur Miller and things like that. You know, because they were serious people, and you know, she was seen as not serious. I mean, and her roles mostly, not all. I mean, she did some dramatic roles that are great, but normally she would be it's some like it hot. You know, 7 year itch. I mean, that's what you think of when you think of Marilyn. And I think that deep down she was extremely insecure. I think she suffered from, you know, imposter syndrome, which so many people do. That they're seen as something really great, and but deep down they don't think they are. And I think a lot of people deal with that that get into all kinds of different parts of writing and show business and acting and all that, directing, you name it. Yeah. You know, I think everybody, I think that are successful deal with that kind of thing. And I think she was a very fragile person underneath, and I think that this just Hollywood just ate her alive.
Yeah,
I mean, I really do.
Do you think? I mean, do you think if there are people that don't suffer from imposter syndrome, are they just like sociopath, narcissistic type?
I don't know.
I feel like everybody.
I think most people who have any kind of success will.
You have to, right?
You have to, because if not, you are. Yeah, you're deranged.
Yeah. I wonder why everybody feels so alone, like the only person going through that.
People don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it much. But, I mean, if you don't, then you're Mickey Rourke, you know? I mean,
sure.
So yeah. Who just, you know, continually thinks they're like the greatest thing to walk the earth. There's always going to be that. There's always those people too. And the entertainment industry breeds those kind of people as well, you know?
Yeah.
So well, I think it goes both ways.
That's a good point. Born Norma Jean Mortensen, June 1st, 1926. Norma Jean was a great hardcore band back in the day. I'm pretty sure that's probably where they took that name.
I would think so.
Her mother, Gladys. It is Gladys?
Yeah, Gladys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Spent most of her daughter's early years in a mental institution. Norma didn't want a messy life like her mother had, so at 16, she married instead of being sent away to another foster home. That's got to be like a terrible kind of like...
We got a great choice.
Choice, you know? Yeah.
And that's something, and it's completely off topic.
Sure.
But not.
As we do.
But yeah. Well, when I was writing about what happened to all the children that survived the Donner Party, because... Mm. That was mostly the children who survived. And all of these girls who lost their parents, they're stuck in California.
What are they going to do?
It's the 1840s. Look how far they are from home. What are they going to do? There's no way to get home. So a lot of them just ended up, either if you wait, were taken in by a family, they got married at 14, 13 years old. And some of them had horrible lives because of it. You know, and this is the same kind of thing. She just marries this guy who seems like a nice enough guy, and because it's better than going to another foster home. I mean, that's horrible. That's the kind of choices you want to
real
have.
Sophie's choice. Yeah,
yeah,
she's
no kidding, man.
She's eventually photographed on the assembly line contributing to the war effort. I could totally see her on some posters for this.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, I've seen the pictures that they used for the magazine. And you know, then she started doing I would say pinup stuff, but that came later. But some of the photos and stuff she did, and I'll be honest with you, I think that she was the prettiest when she still had red hair, young, you know, just with a big smile on her face, when she didn't have to, all she had to do for the camera was smile. She didn't have to be
Marilyn Monroe.
And it's they're pretty amazing to see a lot of her old pictures and realize that, you know, what a cute girl she was and how happy she looks in those. And then to think about how things turned out, because, I mean, she was so young when she died.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it's just, I don't know. I feel this was one that I wanted to end this season with, because I've always just felt so bad for her.
Sure.
You know, and she's just one of those people that you just can't help but think she just got it used and abused by everybody. You know, from the doctors to guys she dated. Honestly, I think the only guy that, and I think I made it clear how I felt about Joe DiMaggio in this episode. I think this is a good dude. And I think he really, really cared for her, but I think that she wanted things Joe didn't, and vice versa.
Sure.
And I think that it just wouldn't work out. But he stuck with her forever. To the end of
her
life,
roses,
he stuck with her, even after she died, right. But I mean, when she needed help, all she'd do was call him. When she got put in that mental institution,
right.
All she did was call, and he showed up and cleaned house, man.
I mean,
he was pissed.
I bet.
And he got there and he just got her out of there. And wasn't it? I mean, he was Joe DiMaggio,
right,
man. I mean, he was the exact he was the sports equivalent of Marilyn Monroe at the time. Uh-huh. I mean, they were the top of
the field. A power couple kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, aside from like pop culture references and things like that, I've never watched a movie with Marilyn Monroe.
Really?
Like, what is she like as an actress? What would you recommend somebody check
out? I think she's really a great actress because she could play this. She was very smart. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about...
I know who you're trying to say.
Oh, my God. I just about said Mamie Van Doren, but that wasn't Jane Mansfield.
There you go.
Who was extremely smart, and yet no one would take her seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think Marilyn had some of the same problems.
It's like the curse of beauty kind of thing?
It was a time period. They both were in that same time period where their popularity came from, and they were both smart women in a very misogynistic business at the time. And they thought,
good thing it's cleaned up.
Well, no, that hasn't changed much. But they also, people wanted, the demand was for these kind of bubbly, you know, airhead types.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, her movies are great. I mean, she's a great actress. She's very funny. Mm-hmm. 7 Year Itch is a great movie. I prefer Some Like It Hot.
Okay.
That's probably my favorite one. Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. You probably don't even remember this show. Do you remember Bosom Buddies?
I have heard of the show, but I know Jack Lemmon Jack Lemmon was a grumpy old man.
Yeah. Okay. But they were obviously much younger.
Yes.
But they wanted to get into they were musicians and they couldn't get jobs, so they ended up joining a women's band dressed as women.
Oh boy.
Which was very funny at the time. I mean, it was and even when Tom Hanks and Peter Sklar did Bosom Buddies, the same kind of thing. They mm-hmm. were these two young guys who couldn't find a good place to live in New York, so they found out about this apartment building that was for all women, and so they dressed up as Phoebe and I can't think of their name. Buffy and I can't remember. I don't remember the
names.
Romy
and Michelle.
No. The movie was funny. Or the TV show was pretty funny.
Oh, it was
and it
a
was
show.
Early Tom Hanks. Yeah, it was a TV show, but it's the same. It's a similar theme, and that's a fun movie. But I mean, she did, you know, plenty of other things, you know, toward, especially later in her career. I'm not a huge fan of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I'm not a big Jane Russell fan, and I don't. And it's a little too musical for me.
But that's the one you said made her a legend.
It did, and it really put her on top. You know, some of her early stuff wasn't seen until later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yeah, it's I think that if you get a chance, sit down and watch. You know, Bus Stop or Some Like It Hot. That's mm-hmm. the one I would recommend for a first timer on Marilyn Monroe. It's just a good movie. And
Fair
I think
enough.
I think you'd enjoy it. You get a lot of laughs out of it. So,
okay. Yeah. You mentioned earlier she and Joe didn't really seem eye to eye. So they get married, but it wouldn't last. What is it about? I don't know if it's just the guys at the top of their field or whatever, but they marry these women who are ambitious as hell. And then they think, oh, they'll settle down and be something completely different.
But that was the stand. That was how things worked at the time.
Even with women at like the top of their game,
it didn't matter. This was an era in American history, maybe world history, but I can speak to American history,
sure.
where women were expected to be housewives, stay home, have kids, take care of the house. That was the standard. That's what people expected.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's be honest, that's what most people did at the time.
Sure.
When you got married. You know, the you could live on one salary back then. It's not like now. In the 1950s, you could live on one salary. You'd have the man who goes to work each day. You know, they have a nice car, a nice automobile. They've got a nice house. White picket fence, goes to work, comes home with it, you know, goes to the ad agency or whatever, like bewitched,
right?
Goes to work, comes home. You know, his wife has a martini waiting for him when he comes in the door and his slippers and the newspaper.
He's got the apron on still.
Yeah, he sits down in the living room and reads the paper.
Just kill
me.
And
she makes dinner and, you know, makes sure the kids did their homework. And, you know, that was idyllic American life.
Yeah, Leave It to Beaver kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Leave It to Beaver is a perfect example of what that was like. And like I said, even Bewitched, and that was the 60s.
Right.
But it was the same kind of thing. I mean, I know we're talking about, you know, Samantha the Witch,
but
the idea of it.
Right.
You know, watch Mad Men. You know, if you watch Mad Men, that's you get a lot of that. And then that's when that's a show about the shifting of society, where
mm-hmm.
the women started to no longer just be secretaries anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and this was the same thing. And I think he was raised very traditionally, you know, in an Italian household. Remember, too, that, you know, during this time period, it was getting better, but, you know, Italians were still you know, not, well, they weren't white.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't all white.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, these are the guys that started to kind of cross that line into people seeing them as, you know, entertainers that were not, you know, and then, so you got DiMaggio, who's, you know, slamming batter, whatever the hell his nickname was.
Right, right.
You're
right.
Talking about Joe, and he's, you know, he is the top of his field, and people started to see Italians as different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was a time period that was starting to change. But he grew up in a household where his father worked and his mother took care of the house.
Yeah.
So that's what he thought it was going to be like. And it wasn't.
Talking
about Marilyn Monroe, it's not that going to be that way. She has a career of her own, and it just did not fly.
Right.
And it was at that point that Marilyn started to kind of balk at a lot of the things the studios wanted to. And,
yes.
You know, by going to New York and joining the Actors Studio and stuff,
yeah.
It's like, that is not what they wanted. They wanted her to just be this bimbo actress, and she wants to be a serious actress, and that's not what they wanted out of her.
And you talk about, so with the personal crisis kind of over, that's when she appears in 7 Year Itch, her last iconic film, the one with the white dress and the mm-hmm. subway grate.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to tell you a story that's gross. When I lived in New York, I had 11 roommates. I think
right.
I told you this.
But that, yeah.
Eventually my office got moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn, so I had a much longer commute.
Yeah.
And I would have to walk in the rain and the snow all the
sure.
time. And the first
uphill
couple
both ways.
Uphill both ways. No shoes. No, I actually had these Walmart boots on that, like, because I would bring shoes
sure.
to change into.
Sure.
But I remember walking there, and at first I was like, okay, these grates are like really gross because they're coming from the subway and all this stuff. Yeah. After a while, I started to directly go above the grates because it was the first warm air
warm.
I was gonna
yeah,
get
exactly
and it's disgusting, but I was like
yeah.
I finally am warm on my mile walk to
yeah,
work and
yeah.
So I get the grates thing, but yeah, that's was my basic knowledge of Marilyn Monroe,
that
iconic
picture,
scene
the
yeah.
photograph
yeah.
of her on standing on the subway grate
yes
yeah.
and it's been recreated
yeah.
so
yeah,
many
yeah.
times
yeah. And Joe was there on the set.
Oh, okay.
Not happy.
Oh,
he
come on,
did
Joe.
Not like that scene.
You can't date a hot girl and get mad about hot girl
I
shit.
I know. And so it just, you know.
Yeah.
That's.
She moves to New York City and joins the Actors Studio in 1955, reunites with Arthur Miller. Did he do Death of a Salesman?
Yes, that's Arthur Miller.
Okay, all right. Okay, no. That's my one little factoid.
Well, Death of a Salesman and The Crucible about the Salem Witch
Trials. Oh, okay,
that's
yeah.
That's him, too.
Okay.
I mean, he obviously wrote other stuff. But,
sure. But
I mean, those are the ones that come to most people's mind.
Right. She films Bus Stop in 1956 in Hollywood, gets solid reviews. She wants to get greater control over her films, which is denied, causes conflicts with studio bosses. That's when she apparently starts drinking more and taking more pills. Never a good combination.
No, it's not.
And far too common for times back then, especially
yeah.
when people have like a doctor.
Well, especially in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, the studios just set you up with the studio doctor and they just prescribe anything you
good
need.
Good to go.
Ask Judy Garland how well that worked out, filming Wizard of Oz.
Oh, boy. Did
look,
you,
here's
did you
a
watch?
Handful of pills to wake up every day and here's a and make sure you lose weight and here's a handful to
go to sleep.
Go to sleep and we'll start over again tomorrow.
Honestly, it hasn't changed so
no,
much
it
as
really
an assembly
hasn't.
Line.
No, you're right.
Adderall and Ambien.
Yeah,
yeah,
it really hasn't.
Right. She eventually has three miscarriages, which I'm yeah. sure also fucks with her mental health
sure.
and everything else. She films The Prince and The Showgirl. It bombs. So then she films Some Like It Hot, like mm-hmm. you say, with Jack
right.
Lemmon and Tony Curtis. Becomes a favorite for millions of her fans, including you, apparently.
It's my favorite of her movies.
But behind the scenes, she's falling apart. The miscarriages and things like that, prescription drugs, sleeping pills, badly affected her work. She's late. She can't really remember her lines. Gets hooked up with Dr. Ralph Greenson, like we're talking about, the so-called psychoanalyst to the stars. Did we talk about him in a different episode?
No,
or
there's just been,
sound
there's
so
just
many of them?
Been so many people like him
okay.
over the last year in these episodes.
So. Got it. Okay, okay. July 1960, she filmed The Misfits. It was not pretty. The day after filming completed, Clark Gable suffers a heart attack and dies.
Yeah, no kidding, right? And it's
shit.
Not a bad movie, but... and that, I believe, now I could be wrong, don't quote me on this. See, you know, people can look things up. You used to be able to just make things up.
Yeah.
Know, but
oh,
now you can't.
Back
so,
in the day,
no,
the
I'm
good old
kidding.
Days.
Yeah, but I think that was her only nude scene.
Oh,
on film,
okay,
is
okay.
in The Misfits, I
got
think.
It. I'm not going to Google that later. It's fine.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, like you said, she gets committed, becomes kind of suicidal, locked up. Joe DiMaggio comes in to the rescue.
Yeah.
It's, again, it's I don't know, it's upsetting to see just people struggling with their
apart
people struggling with their mental health, and to see that even people who might seem like they have everything, like they don't, you know, or they're just as susceptible to these terrible things as we are. This next section I have titled "Hail to the Chief." So this is October 1961. Marilyn has her first meeting with John F. Kennedy. They meet again in New York City and then Palm Springs at Bing Crosby's, where their affair allegedly started. I mean, so we don't have hard and fast proof, right? But, like, they were fucking, right?
Well,
probably.
We assume so. I mean, you know, you base that on the fact that she was, I think, easily manipulated by power. I see Kennedy as a Bill Clinton-esque.
Well, he talked about what, quote, like needing a new woman every couple of days,
all
like
kinds
some
of
shit.
Stuff.
Like,
so I mean, he had a reputation as a dog, you know, and so I think that I would be very surprised if it's not true.
Yeah.
But I mean, we can't prove it, but we do know there were an awful lot of phone calls and there's plenty of, you know, hit and miss kind of circumstantial evidence.
But right.
I don't think there's no photographs of them or anything like that. So,
you know what? Good for her. I hope if she.
I don't think so.
You don't think
I don't
so?
Think that was a good thing. I
Why
think
not?
That was what.
Oh, led to her. Demise.
Led to everything. I think. And I'm not even saying conspiracy here. I'm saying that.
Like mentally?
That mentally, that I think that he used her and manipulated her the same way that. Well, look what happened to Monica Lewinsky. I mean, she's finally bounced back.
True.
Jesus, what a mess she had to go through. She was just a kid.
That's very
true. At least
true.
Marilyn wasn't a kid, but I still think she was easily manipulated.
Well, okay, two things. First off, Monica Lewinsky also, badass bitch. Now
I love she's great.
Oh,
I love
she's
her.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I
she
love
really how, bounced back.
She's
big.
So open and like talks about this
I
stuff
really
and,
like
and jokes about it too. All right, you know what? You've convinced me now. Yeah, fuck Kennedy. I'm
well,
mad
it's not. I mean, you know, I mean that doesn't mean that he was a bad president.
About politics.
I mean, outside of politics, I don't think. I think his personal life, like Bill Clinton's, was and is. Well, not Kennedy.
I was gonna say,
but,
wait,
but I think his personal life was a mess.
Yeah,
and
well, he probably
he
hurt
got
more
away
people.
With he got away with stuff his whole life.
Yeah,
he came from a rich, wealthy family from grew up in Hyannis, Massachusetts, and they're blue blood Kennedys, and they could do anything. Well,
didn't one of them actually get away with murder?
Literally got away with murder.
They, I was gonna say,
then there's old Ted with the girl for the drowning. We could go on, and we don't need to. I'm just saying that the Kennedys were a train wreck too.
Sure.
So, and I think that they sort of. I think Marilyn was collateral damage.
Oh, well.
That's my opinion.
I was just happy she landed a president, but now that you explain it that way.
Yeah, I don't see it as, I don't see it as something good. So,
well, damn. Well, yeah. You know what? I'm walking back the jokes. Okay. The studio stressed out about the cost of Cleopatra and wanted to cancel Marilyn's film.
With Dean Martin,
right. And which, I guess nowadays, like looking back, obviously you have, hindsight and all that, but it's like, wait, you want to cancel this thing that,
Cleopatra?
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I was going to say you want to cancel something with Marilyn.
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
I get looking back, you can see
a disaster.
Sure, I know.
It sucks.
Haven't seen it.
Not only does it suck, but it was so much money.
Well, it's over budgeted. Yeah,
completely waste of time.
I was going to ask you if I should even check it out.
Oh my God, no! It's so awful. It's just one of those big costume drama things. It was just it was just a vehicle for Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, and who were both way too old to be playing those characters even then. And it's an awful film, and it was a disaster.
Good to know.
It lost so much money.
I bet. In protest, Marilyn flies to New York City where she sings Happy Birthday to Kennedy, the now infamous clip, which made the studio bosses even angrier. She comes back, tries to be cool. She's fired for her, quote, unprofessional antics. The studio also files a $750,000 lawsuit against her and try to get a recast. But Dean Martin's like, no, I'm not going to work with anybody else.
Yeah, I'm not going to work with anybody else. Which is, took some balls on his part to do it. I mean, although he and the Rat Pack were extremely famous at the time. And so he was able to throw his weight around. But... Well, I've always liked Dean Martin. I've always found him to be one of the laziest of the bunch of performers.
Okay.
Just because he never had to try hard. And he never did. I mean, it was always... There was a quote about him that said, Dean is the nicest guy until he and I'm paraphrasing. Yeah, yeah. Something about he's such a nice guy. He'll go out of his way to be nice to everybody until he runs out of nice. And then he just leaves.
He doesn't give a shit. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I just always liked the dude. I mean, he was playing, he was not drunk, playing it drunk on stage, pretty much.
So did he have apple juice?
And a cigarette. Yeah, it was all kinds of stuff. He wouldn't really be drinking. He wouldn't really be drunk, but that was his shtick with Sammy and,
right,
you know, and stuff and Sinatra and
maybe,
stuff.
Maybe
and
that could be my persona.
There you go. But I just always liked him. I just always thought he seemed like such a cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe he wasn't, but it worked with me. His persona worked with me. And then, you know, when I came across this and he's like, nope, I'm not working with anybody else. I thought, you know what? That's really cool.
Right. So. Yeah. No, I like that. He said August 1st. So she signs a contract for $250,000 more to finish filming Something's Gotta Give. Is this a common thing to like to isn't it worked out beforehand?
I thought that was weird, but maybe it was done differently then, but that's that's weird. Maybe they, because of there were going to be a lot more reshoots or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I was kind of just curious
too. Yeah,
about that. It's like, I'd just be like, Marilyn, you want to finish this fucking movie or not?
Yeah,
like,
right?
What are we doing here? Okay, Saturday, August 4th, 1962. Marilyn's home all day. Her only guest was her publicist, Pat Newman, that we know of. Later reports claim Robert Kennedy visited, but you said there's no proof of that.
Right.
This whole night and everything's messy
as
hell.
Yeah, it's a mess.
And because
everyone was lying. Well, it's Hollywood.
Yeah.
Everyone lies about everything. And that was the problem. They were lying about everything. And the cops were like, what do we do with this? Because no one will tell us the truth. So
what do you do? Yeah, so you said she called Peter Lawford and canceled the dinner invitation. He was concerned about her, but like not. Yeah. He's advised like,
but
hey.
Everybody's like, but you know, you don't want to go over there. It's going to look bad. What if she offs herself?
Right.
And then you'll have been around her house. And seriously. And, you know, because he's the president's brother-in-law, well, that's going to look bad.
Yeah.
So he doesn't go. But at least he tries to continue to call and stuff.
I wanted to say, there was one time that this woman couldn't get a hold of me, and my little brother climbed up the balcony of my apartment, slid open the door, walked in, shined a flashlight in my face, and I was like, what are you doing? And he goes, I was just making sure you're okay. And then he just leaves. Like, did a wellness check on me like that. It's like, so I'm just saying, you know, it matters when people actually come through
and can help you out. Yeah.
Peter's unable to reach Marilyn, calls her agent, because that's kind of, like you said, like the
Hollywood
shit,
man.
Works.
Yeah.
And then it's, quote, it is unknown how many other calls came into or were made from Marilyn's house that night. The telephone records for the night of August 4th mysteriously disappeared after being obtained by authorities.
We do know
the phone
that she
company.
Called Joe DiMaggio's son, because he'd recently broken up with his girlfriend.
Right.
They had been close. She
right.
was close still with Joe's son.
I was thinking about that. Like,
again.
How cool
like
would it
nice
be?
People.
Well, how cool would it be to be like, okay, I'm upset about, you know, losing this girl, or whatever, and then having fucking Marilyn being like, you know what?
Feel better.
Yeah, you're hot, honey. You got
I'm all right.
Like,
yeah
if Marilyn Monroe's the one I'm talking to, like, I'm good to go after that. Again, the story keeps changing from Eunice Murray, who's not a nurse but is kind of a nurse.
Spy for the doctor. That's what they think anyway.
Time of death's all over the place. Let's see. So her eventually, she dies. What the hell do you think happened?
I don't know, man.
And who helped?
I don't know. I mean, there's been so many theories. I mean, obviously something weird happened. I mean, why weren't there pills in her stomach?
Yeah.
You know, it just, I mean, did she OD? Did she not OD? You know, they said she did. Did she do it herself? I mean, I can't see her. You know, everybody talk about, you know, well, maybe that somebody gave her, you know, all the pills in an enema, you know, and killed her that way. Because I can't imagine she'd have done that to herself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But even also, why would the doctor do that?
Yeah,
just
none
to
of it makes,
what the hell
I don't know,
happens?
None of it makes any sense. And, you know, I mean, there's so many theories. You know, was it the mob? Was it, you know, was it revenge against the Kennedys, trying to make them look bad? And I don't know, man. I really don't. I just, it's so confusing and there's so much stuff.
Yeah.
And it's so messy that it just, I don't know. I just feel like you start getting down this stuff, you're going down a rabbit hole that with questions that will never be answered.
Sure.
You know, I tried to cover all that stuff, and you know, in some of this stuff,
and you did.
I traced some of it back to Norman Mailer's biography, and people ask him why. Well, why did you say that? Well, because I needed money.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Well, that's really, you know,
reassuring.
And really, the way I look at it is there's just lots of people who were throwing in things that, you know, anytime there was an odd time lapse or a weird story or something didn't seem right. I mean, the cops, I mean, don't get me wrong. When the cops show up at the house, they can't get the doctor and the nurse. They can't get them to answer a question straight. Nothing they say makes any sense. And so, I mean, the cops were suspicious of them, but they couldn't prove anything. There was just no actual evidence of what happened.
Yeah.
And so it just, I don't know, just became a huge mess. I mean, maybe it was an accident. We'll never know. It didn't seem like she would have committed suicide because things seem to be kind of on an upswing again. But on the other hand, all the time.
Yeah.
You know, but they seem great, you know, or they seem like they were doing so much better. And you don't know. I think that she had a lot of psychiatric issues for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in, I think, fragile mental health, fragile physical health parts of the time, on all kinds of drugs, up and down, all over the place. And I think that, I really think Hollywood just chewed her up and spit her out.
So even if that is the, even if is it the was case?
Even if she didn't commit suicide, she did a Heath Ledger and just took too much.
Right, but what do you think, what would you say about the lack of drugs, or I guess barbiturates in particular in her system? Do you think that's a lie or a botched autopsy
Who
thing?
Who knows? That's the thing. We'll never know. There's just too many unanswered questions. And then, you know, you're talking about Thomas Noguchi, who was the coroner who
was
and you probably don't remember much about him, but there was a while, this might have been, man, I can't remember, but this might have been like late 80s, and he was famous for all the autopsies that he'd done and turned that into like a celebrity thing.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's like, who does that? Yeah. Should you even be talking about this stuff? I mean,
probably
this
not.
Is... I mean, I suppose it's public record when it gets entered in, but God, how tacky.
It's like a lot of celebrities and stuff. I just always thought he was a goof.
Yeah, I just always thought he was, I don't know, he just never seemed reliable to me. But maybe I was just turned off by him doing autopsies on celebrities like Belushi.
So he's like the coroner to the stars kind of shit?
Yeah, it's like, God, what is wrong with you? You know? He's always got excuses about I was just starting out about Maryland's
autopsy.
So that's a disaster. Nobody knows where the phone records are. I mean, it's just a mess.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll never get to the bottom of it. I don't care every time a book comes along or movie comes along or whatever that, oh, they're going to answer the question. Dude, that's like trying to tell me that you know who Jack the Ripper was. No one knows.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to know. I'll know when I die.
Sure.
And then I'll find out that none of it was true, probably. But and this is going to be the same kind of thing. We're never going to know what really happened. There's just no way to solve this.
And
there just isn't.
And it really seems like, I know you didn't want to dive into the mob stuff. It just seems like if the mob wanted to connect it, they probably would have done a better job.
Yeah. Well, mostly because... I mean, again, let's be honest, mob guys are not exactly criminal geniuses most of the mob stuff
don't talk shit on the mob right now.
But of their stuff is a club and stick kind of method of crime, which means that they're just kill you if you get out of the way.
Right.
Would they really go to some elaborate scheme like this? I mean, that's something like the CIA would do around this time when they're, you know, trying to blow up exploding cigars on Castro and stuff. Come on. And so, you know, this elaborate scheme of making it look like the Kennedys were involved. I mean, they weren't going to do that. If they wanted her dead, she'd be dead. If they wanted to kill the Kennedys, they'd have killed the Kennedys.
Yeah.
And well, maybe they did.
Maybe
you know?
They
I
did.
Mean, you know,
somebody
so maybe
did.
Somebody did. Other than Sirhan, the assassin who's so nice you say his name twice.
You want to go into this?
But
you
no,
said no.
I don't.
Okay, you said
but
specifically
all I'm
not
saying,
to.
All I'm saying is that I don't buy that either. I think that either the doctor had something to do with it or it was an accident. Or she killed herself. There's three options.
Sure, that seem plausible.
That seem plausible, and I don't, and we're never going to know.
If it was an accident on either part, like the doctors could have just been like, look, she fucking did it on accident. Like, why would they?
I know.
I don't know how I would act either.
Well, but here's the thing, though. Again, we're getting back into something that this was a different time.
Sure. Okay.
And so you are dealing with a different kind of situation where She's a huge celebrity.
Yeah.
And do they want to talk about, does the studio want it known that she committed suicide?
Fair enough.
Wouldn't it be easier to make this all look mysterious? We know, we have, for a year now, we have, how many episodes have we dealt with where the studio came in? They were still powerful mm-hmm. in the early 60s when they came in and cleaned up crime scenes, got rid of stuff. We'll never know. We'll never know if somebody didn't.
They want to control the narrative, though? I feel like with this, it's like they're trying to leaving it open-ended.
Well, but by leaving it open, mm-hmm. there's always a question of whether she killed herself.
Oh, all right.
You know, and if you just leave it open, it could have been an accident. You know,
I don't know how Hollywood works, obviously.
I know. Me either. Just going by some of the stuff we've dealt with, I mean, you look at some of the dirty stuff the studio's pulled over the years. I don't see where it's that hard to believe that they didn't control this narrative by making it look uncontrolled.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know.
It could have been.
I promised we wouldn't do this.
Yeah, but I wanted to.
And get into conspiracies. But
it could be something as simple as like there was a note and somebody took it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know?
And like that's it.
The nurse, the doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the cops who showed up. We'll never know.
Yeah. It could have been something that simple.
It could have been something that easy. You're right.
Anyway, on that happy note, let's talk about Marilyn's ghost.
Sure.
You mentioned
pretty
that,
busy, that, like Valentino.
Yeah, or Lincoln or somebody. Yeah. But Marilyn's ghost. You said another distraught woman. In Hollywood,
woman with
Anna Nicole Smith.
Yeah, lived in Marilyn's house.
Claimed, and that's like so fitting, I guess, because of how that all went down.
Although, really. Talent and everything else, I think Mamie Van Doren's house would have been more fitting, but okay. Whatever. She aspired to be Marilyn.
Sure. So. Well, I just think that, like, I was thinking about, you know, ghosts and ghost stories and why certain people might see them and all that, but, like, I guess it would make sense.
It does.
You know, for
it really does, because here's a very troubled young woman like Marilyn
with
was,
drugs and
with
everything else.
All kinds of stuff. And her seeing or, you know, having a connection with or encounters with Marilyn's ghost totally makes sense.
Yeah, like I'm trying to save you from what happened.
Yeah, it was like one of those things where when I first ran across that, I was like, well, of course she did.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like not a surprise at all.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's tragic. It didn't work. So I don't know. So if you see a ghost, doing what you're doing.
Whatever it is, if it's connected to whatever you're doing at the time, you might want to
take it as a sign. Yeah. I don't know. Easier said than done. Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. She's seen in a mirror, which also makes sense if she's all about being vain.
Well, I think the
vanity
mirror used to hang in her favorite suite, or at least that's what they said. So
you said even Nick Lachey thinks he saw a ghost in an elevator.
You know, there's in 2006 he was. Still had a career.
Does
he have one now? Is he game shows or something?
He does some shit like that. And I got no beef with any boy band people, but like, it is really random and funny that he comes into this episode out of nowhere.
It is funny.
I love that his name's gonna get a little Google boost and he's gonna probably freak out. It's gonna be
someone,
of our podcast.
There are people listening to this going, who the fuck is Nick Lachey? So,
I'm not gonna tell you. Just Google it because that'd be really funny. Yeah. Now, when you start to look up things for the podcast, here's what I want people to do. Use Ask Jeeves because I want
Jeeves? That doesn't even exist anymore, is it?
It still does. It redirects you to ask.com. But what I want Troy, here's what I want to happen. I want their numbers to randomly spike and them to have no idea why or what's happening.
Okay.
Just like, we just got a huge bump, like 1,000.
Ask Jeeves.
Just Ask Jeeves where you have a Google, a Butler Google.
I really
Google
didn't
stuff.
Think that was around anymore.
It's ask.com and it's owned by some conglomerate, but it'd just be funny to me.
That's funny.
There's even at a bungalow in Lake Tahoe, her ghost is seen, and then her crypt in Westwood Village Memorial Park, where, like you said, Joe DiMaggio sent flowers until his death in
1999.
Yeah,
every week, red roses came for her. Every week without fail.
That's that man fell hard.
I know.
I
think I mentioned another place in the story instead of the end, but. I mean, right shortly before he died, he told his friend, well, I'm going to get to see Marilyn again.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Jeez.
So,
is that true love? Is that what that is?
I guess it must be. I'm sure that he regretted a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but there was talk of them maybe getting back together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was talk of that. So that might have, who knows, if she'd lived longer, maybe, well, things obviously would have been different. I always think of that. And lots of people we've talked about this season, what if they had lived longer?
Yeah.
you know, people like James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, you know, and all the musicians and things we talked about.
I think about all the time, Kurt Cobain talked about, he's like right now,
but Kurt Cobain was doomed to die young. That was gonna happen.
Well,
this was a guy who was like a walking billboard for suicide. Well, let's be honest.
Okay, but
it was not a shock.
I'm only saying because
sad, but not a shock.
I'm only bringing this up because he said, right now we jump around with our guitars and like smash it. He said, I can't wait till the day that I'm older and I can just sit on a stool with an acoustic guitar and just play the songs I want to play.
Sure.
And he wanted to be like Johnny Cash kind of thing. Well, he did, but I think
unplugged.
Okay. Oh my God. Okay. Yes, the one Nirvana thing everybody knows. But
I know.
Anyway, I bring that up because he wanted that to happen in the future. But of course, yeah, you do that much heroin, like
come on, man.
Yeah. But anyway, I wonder about those people too, and what would have happened, and what art would they have created, or what cool things would they have done?
Because I mean, you know, the actors that did live to be quite a bit older, you know, that are still around, or at least live to be quite a bit older, you know, some of them did great things, some of them didn't.
Did nothing.
You know, didn't really do anything, retired early and moved on, you know, or, you know, you're Shirley Temple, you become a UN ambassador. I mean, you know,
right.
and leave it all behind when you turn 18, you know, there's such a different dynamic with all these people. And the ones who died tragically, the reason that we revere people like Marilyn, James Dean, Elvis, although Elvis outlived his usefulness as far as I'm concerned, but that's whatever. But the reason that we revere a lot of those people is because they did die young and left all this potential. You know,
right.
And so it's not surprising then that we also get ghost stories with these people. Too.
Sure. Yeah. Because how many of them would have been like, if they had lived their lives, would be like, wait, Marilyn, who are you?
Yeah.
Talking? Like, you know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. It's certainly possible. Or let's say she stayed married to James Doherty back in, you know, I mean, what if?
Yeah.
You know, what if?
Not everyone can become a Betty White where we must protect her at all costs.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay, that's the story on Marilyn Monroe.
That's
the end of the season. Yeah. I want to give a quick couple of Patreon shout-outs to new subscribers for helping us keep the show going and doing the bonus episodes. Like you said, we're going to keep doing once the season ends.
Yeah, we do have a few more Hollywood stories
and
our Patreon.
We're going to do some Hollywood stories, and then I think I'm just going to start interviewing people that do random stuff in our kind of realm and world
because we have a lot of plans on stuff. We're finally getting together with technology that we've been able to upgrade.
There's a lot of fun people I want to talk to. So I just want to give a quick shout out to Chris, Diane, Patty, Sarah, Katrina, Wendy, Leba, I don't know, Tim, and Maggie.
Awesome.
So thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Again, it helps us do what we want to do. It is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This email is from Jordan. He included his Instagram handle, so I'm guessing he wants me to include that. But it's Santana on Fire. The email says, first and foremost, love the pod, even season 1, in parentheses. Longtime listener, sometimes emailer, Instagram commenter, tagger. Honestly, your podcast is the podcast that got me into podcasts. I'm so sorry. And now I listen to them more than music, reserving music mostly for my vinyl collection. I actually use a semicolon here in the correct way, and I appreciate that. Because
so obviously someone not much smarter than we are.
I have no idea how to really use one. Love the movies you cover in this episode. No objections. Have some movies I need to rewatch now. Watch The Changeling on Troy's recommendation.
Oh, the 70s episode.
Yeah.
The reason a couple people complain, but a couple things I left off.
I saw that.
But remember,
too.
The reason I left them off is because I didn't really like them that much.
Yeah, they're our favorites. Yeah,
they might have been fine, but I didn't. You know, I don't like Texas Chainsaw Massacre that much. I see it's for what it is. But
I want to let people in on a little industry secret here. So when BuzzFeed writes an article, the top 10 horror movies in the 1990s, they leave off one or two of the biggest ones
to
get you to comment
because it
shows Facebook, hey, this post is engaging.
Sure.
They do it to fuck with you, and your hate literally fuels them. And sometimes we do
no
this.
No one hated on us. They just wanted this or that.
I just want to let people know that's how Zuckerberg and Meta or whatever works now. That's a whole other thing.
I don't understand that.
So
at all.
The reason I write today is because, back to the email, the reason I write today is because there's an occasional.
Isn't that the social media company that Ryan was trying to start on The Office?
No, that was So they
seem like the same thing.
People
to me,
did
so.
Bring that up in really? Memes and memes, funny. But that was Wolf.
Wolf. That's anyway. Great. Sorry, go ahead.
You're
good. I'm sorry.
Jordan email. Okay. The reason I write today is because there's an occasional mechanical whirring sound in the background of the recording, at least toward the beginning. More that it gave me nostalgia for HP season one. I tease. I have your Patreon. Love you guys. It sounds like our litter robot when it rotates to sift the litter. Look it up if you have a cat. And so I said, more than that, our cat likes to fuck with it when it's cleaning itself, which causes it to stop and then start again a little later. It was tripping me out while I was listening to the episode. I kept poking my head around to the bathroom where it is, and nothing. No cat, litter robot glowing blue, sitting at the ready for some cat turds to clean. Then I realized it was almost imperceptible sound in the background of this episode. It stops at the first 10 minutes or so. All that to say, good job spooking me out, even if unintentional. Keep up the good work. Love your horror movie recap episodes almost as much as the regular episodes. Cody, your friendship with Sean O'Connell turned me onto the Real Blend podcast, thus expanding my podcast playlist. My pending review of their pod will certainly give you a shout out. I wanted to bring this one up specifically today because Troy and I were talking earlier about we heard like kids and people yelling and shit earlier. And we're saying how like most of the time you can't hear them. I know what this sound was. It was the air conditioner that kicked on when we were in the room the other day.
Yeah, we were in a big party room.
Yeah, and the air kicked
and
on.
It was yeah,
and then it stopped, and I turned it off after that.
It's not like where we normally record. Yes, we're set up somewhere.
And
else.
I remember when it did. I was like, I don't think anyone can hear this at this point. Yeah. But Jordan called it out.
His ears were too finely tuned.
They were.
For
yeah.
Show.
Did you have headphones in? just listen to it on your phone while you're cleaning your apartment like a normal
while
person.
While the vacuum is running, hair dryer's on, whatever. It
the
sounds
blender's
great.
Going.
The show sounds great under those circumstances.
It's great. But I just thought it was really funny because Troy and I were talking about earlier, like, nobody can hear these little demonic kids and people in the hallway and shit. And I was like, wait, Jordan
and like,
can.
And then we're like, okay, so we really need to do this studio thing, don't we? I guess we better work on that.
We should, but it keeps things interesting. Keeps me on my toes.
I know. I still remember when we used to have the kids screaming in the pool and we'd get messages from people about
ghostly.
I hear like these ghostly voices of children. Yeah, we know.
Yeah, we know. Thanks. Fuck. That's all I got, dude. What do you have to take us out for season five
so,
of the podcast? All right.
So the deal was that I could do this thing that I wanted to do.
What deal? With who? Who did you
with
make
you.
A deal?
And then I said that I would let you uninterrupted read the end.
Okay.
If you let me play one last Orson Welles commercial. I had people asking me for Orson Welles.
So the deal is I let you play this shit and then I get to do my shit.
And I will not interrupt you.
All right. Okay. Per this deal that I didn't know about. Sure.
Well,
for the last time.
I just knew you'd
agree. Yeah. Play your fucking Orson Welles and let's just get this over with.
I like to cast a party the way I cast a play with very special people. And the champagne must be equally special. Mm-hmm. Paul Masson, a premium California champagne.
Okay, I can't do this. So this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written by Troy Taylor. It is produced and edited by me, Cody Zabanger. If you're not a regular listener of the podcast, you're going to be really confused right now, but we hope you'll check out a bi-weekly dose of history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows. See the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos, links, and more of Troy pouting. If you're a regular listener, we hope you'll take the time to review us on Apple Podcast app and share the show with neighbors, relatives, friends, people you pass on the street, whomever.
That's okay, because I'll have the last laugh when I have an entire Orson Welles episode.
And wouldn't do the show without you. If you're
people.
A fan, then so you also know that American Hauntings is not just this podcast. It's books, tours, events, and more. And our main website is AmericanHauntings.net. And for those of you who write to us and tell us you wish we posted shows more often, especially about Orson Welles, apparently, you can have fresh content if you support the show on Patreon. That's not the
about
only
Orson
part
Welles.
That you get either. Yeah, you get shit about Orson Welles.
We have other stories.
There's discounts.
There are
shirts,
tons of episodes.
Stuff in the mail. A bunch of stories. Troy's a never-ending well of just... Orson Welles information. But for those who don't understand how important our Patreon is to us, go back and listen to the first season and then listen to this one. Yeah, that's right. Patreon is what made it all get better. We weren't arguing or anything in the first season. So check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And if you have comments about the show, suggestions, reviews, jokes, or just want to tell us what you really think of us, I'm not going to care until season six. So let us know. We're reachable via email.
Hey, should we give some
on Twitter? Should,
you know, we didn't talk about
Instagram,
that.
Facebook, messaging.
No,
but Carrie,
no. Seriously though, we didn't talk about what kind of rough schedule that we were going to have as far as the next season goes.
Oh,
yeah. We probably should have done that before now, in case anyone tuned out after the Orson Welles commercial.
This is probably the best time to discuss this.
Yeah, it probably is, because we really don't know what we're talking about. But
we don't.
We are going to do. There will be a trailer coming up soon for the next season, for
yes.
season six. And then we will begin that when we will have a hard date for you when we do that, as far as when we're going to start the episodes, but it will be in January.
Perfect.
But between now and then, we will also have our year-end movie episode that we always do at Christmas time.
And we can tell people during that episode, maybe at the beginning, maybe not literally before the literal last line of the podcast, we can tell people
literally
when this is going to happen.
It really is the last line.
It really is
the
last
line. Holy crap, I didn't realize that. So,
until next season, I guess, if you're a regular listener, goodbye. So long.
Bye, guys.
See
Thank
you later.
You.
Thank you. Oh, all right. That's just under an hour.
Oh, wow.
That was a good one. I feel like we got into some fun, interesting stuff.
Too.